was scattered with rocks, each the size of a large ottoman, and in her rush to get inside, Haley had barely avoided running into one. She cursed under her breath. She'd be on her ass if she wasn't careful. She was outwardly cranky, but could feel the excitement in her revving up like a Corvette at a stoplight. The invitation had said the gathering was to be held in the big observation room at the top of the tower, but the curator's office was tucked away down a short corridor. She thought she'd let the crowd get started, talking, drinking, before she slipped away. Haley thought of her time with Christopher Thomas, what she'd expected, all their pillow talk that had amounted to nothing. The fog glowed ahead, the light from the museum's entrance softened and diffused. Other people were coming up behind her, vague figures making their way through the courtyard. She could hear murmured snatches of disembodied conversation.
"Jesus, what are we in for?"
a male voice said softly, but whoever he spoke to didn't answer. The tower was barely visible through the fog, an unlikely lighthouse, shaped like an upside-down ziggurat of glass and concrete blocks. The fog was thick enough to shroud the lower part of the building, making the low, circular roof look as though it were floating. Stan Ballard thought, "This is insane. I'm insane. What was I thinking?" He stood just outside the museum, wreathed in fog. For one more moment, he thought about leaving, then opened the door.
Chapter 20 by Thomas Cook. One by one, the snakes slithered in, and John Nunn found himself looking at each of them as if he were trying to pick a face from a line of mugshots. There was Justine Olegard, dressed in black, with a single strand of white pearls and spiked heels, but otherwise quite somber in her appearance. She was talking to two people he didn't know. Perhaps she knew them, perhaps she didn't. It wouldn't matter to Justine. She was used to glad-handing strangers, talking up the museum, angling for a donation. It wouldn't surprise him if she managed to pass the cup a little even tonight. Something in Justine never quite turned off. She was like a candle that never sputtered out, though he'd never been able to figure out exactly what her light revealed. Suddenly, as if summoned, Justine broke away from the two people. She'd probably gotten the message that they were of limited means or indifferent to art or had sunk their money into some hospital wing that bore their names and would thus not be making a contribution to the McFall. Whatever it was, it had caused Justine abruptly to lose interest. Nunn glanced in the other direction, to where he could see Peter Hewson, uncomfortably flanked by his niece and nephew, Rosemary's two children. Rosemary had been convicted when they were still young, and Nunn wondered how they'd fared beneath the burden of having their mother executed for the murder of their father. He couldn't imagine their uncle providing solace. Something about Peter Hewson added little knife points to the air. It was as if he made a tiny slit in everyone he met, which no doubt explained why Ben and Layla looked so uneasy at the moment, both of them glancing about in a way that showed just how quickly they wanted to get away from their uncle. There was something icy in the way they stood a little too far away from him for actual conversation, both quite stiff, though only Ben had his arms folded, the sure sign that he felt himself under attack. Layla's attitude was just as wary, it seemed to Nunn, so that she appeared less enclosed within a family circle than trapped in a steadily closing vice. "Hello, Nunn?" Nunn turned, surprised to find Stan Ballard standing beside him.
"I didn't think you were coming,"
Nunn said. "Well, a man has to be careful, don't you think?"
"Careful about what?"
"Leaving his wife in the arm of her ex-husband," Stan answered. "Old fires sometimes give off new sparks, right?" Nunn shrugged. Stan glanced around the room. You must really be in your element, Nun.
In what way?
Oh, you know. Everyone gathered together in one place. All the suspects in the parlor.
Suspects?
Of murder most foul. Stan smiled. Don't expect me to believe you're not thinking of Rosemary's case. Of course, Nunn had been thinking of nothing but the murder since his arrival at the museum. He'd never been able to get it out of his mind. It had spread over his life like a stain, and even now he could feel that stain still spreading. He thought of the way those old Cold War films used to show the red tide of communism sweeping over Europe and Asia. Rosemary's crime and punishment was like that, he thought, a force that had engulfed his life. You must be reviewing the whole thing, Stan said lightly, so that Nunn thought he was being vaguely mocked, or if not that, then reduced to a prissy little parlor mystery stereotype, or worse, a rumpled gumshoe going over yellowing case files while his life trickled away in futile reenactments and baseless surmises. He was thinking that neither of these unflattering visions of himself was wholly inaccurate as he watched Belle and Don McGuire arrive. Belle as beautiful as ever, the perfect California girl, Don every inch the thuggish ex-con. So what are you thinking, detective? Stan asked with a laugh. Actually, I was thinking that that guy there once beat the hell out of Christopher Thomas. It had come out at the trial, and briefly at the time, Nunn had wondered if Don had been in some way connected to Christopher Thomas's murder. Stan's gaze shifted over to the man Nunn indicated. Who's the girl on his arm?
That's his wife, Belle.
Nunn answered. Rosemary tried very hard to help her rise in the art world here. And you think the husband might have felt that their relationship was a little too close? Stan asked. Nunn shook his head.
Who knows?
He answered impatiently, now tired of the little game Stan was still playing with him. The shadow knows, Stan answered with a laugh. But the question remains.
What question?
Stan's smile slithered into place. Who is the shadow? With that, Stan stepped away, then walked over to Sarah, took her arm, and placed it in his, a gesture of possession Nunn knew he was clearly meant to see, and one that Sarah just as clearly resented. As well she should, he thought, since it was as crude as a prospector staking a claim. Still, he found Sarah's ultimate acceptance of the gesture somewhat painful, so that he turned from the scene and fixed his attention on Haley Patchett, who caught his eye and smiled. He wondered how much of anything she'd told him the other day was true. Now in the museum she was drifting from place to place, sometimes stopping for conversation, but clearly uninterested in engaging anyone for long. Something about her movements was odd, Nunn thought. Purposeful, like a cat in an unfamiliar room, sniffing here, there, everywhere. Haley had always been something of a prowler, of course. Rosemary had certainly detested her. And for a moment Nunn could almost feel Rosemary at his side, watching with the same odd suspicion as Haley sauntered about. The tingling sense of Rosemary's presence beside him was strange, but then that was the way it worked with a haunting case. It was like a body that never cooled. And Rosemary's never had.
The shadow knows.
This time it was Rosemary's voice rather than Stan's, and John felt an odd quiver because he had heard it so distinctly, a whisper, or perhaps a hiss. Rosemary's angry ghost. For a moment he surveyed the shadows that surrounded him, and it occurred to him that Stan, arrogant bastard that he was, had been right. John had come to this service not to remember Rosemary in death, but to return her to his life, not to memorialize, but to resurrect her. Perhaps all the debts he'd incurred in pursuit of her were now demanding to be paid no less adamantly than Rosemary's ghost had suddenly demanded to be heard. Without realizing it, he suddenly whispered her name. Rosemary. In his imagination, all movement abruptly stopped, and slowly, as if controlled by invisible strings, each head turned to face him. Stan, Haley, Justine, Tony, Sarah, Belle, Don, even Rosemary's own children, all of them now peering at him coldly, with their lips tightly sealed.
Chapter 21 by Diana Gabaldon. The door of Justine's office opened with a loud click, but nobody was around to hear it. An attendant was guarding the roped-off ramp to the lower exhibit galleries, but Haley had gotten rid of him by telling him a locked car had its lights on in the parking lot, having made sure on her way in that there was a locked car with its lights on. By the time the attendant checked out the car for a license number, came in, went upstairs and found the owner, she hoped to be done here and gone. She could count on 10 minutes clear, she thought, and with luck, it would take no more than half that. Justine, bless her heart, had left a small lamp on in her office. Great, no fumbling around in the dark. Haley scanned the office, her fingers itching with acquisitiveness, trying to decide where to start. Her eyes fixed on Justine's desk, as good a place as any. She walked over noiselessly and carefully opened one of the side drawers. There had to be something here, something she could use to get what she wanted from Justine. Chapter 22 by Peter James. Away from the hubbub of conversation, the silence in this room felt intense, and the strong, sterile smell of polish was intense, too. Haley's nerves were popping, and she had a faint throbbing, like a pulse, in her ears. She was nervous as hell, but she was here, ready. Then she heard voices approaching. She froze. It sounded as though they were just opposite the door to the office. Jesus, who was it? She held her breath. She tried to calm herself. It was probably just a couple of guests who had slipped away from the reception in the observation room of the tower, giving themselves a tour. They must have been staring at a painting that she'd seen and thought it might have been hung upside down. She caught a snatch of their conversation. "It's revisionist postmodernist," one of them said. "Definite juxtaposition of Klimt and Chagall, you know what I'm saying, with a surrealist, or is it closer to Dada, overlay. You wouldn't perceive that in any visual context, but to me it's like they're a kind of metaphorical palimpsest." That old museum curator, Alex something or other. Haley remembered how much Christopher had resented him. She waited until their voices drifted farther down the hallway, then took a deep breath and tried to focus on what she was doing. But her nerves were shot to hell, her eyes leaping erratically around the room. It was spare and minimalist. Glass table, white furniture and blinds, bare wooden flooring. She looked at the prints and paintings hung on the walls, then the small, precious-looking objet d'art that sat on the flat surfaces. She looked down at the desk. It had to be in here somewhere. But where? She noticed a tiny bronze statuette near the desk lamp and slipped it into her handbag. Shit, this whole world could have been hers, a thought that kept recurring as she stood at Justine Olegard's desk. A small vase of flowers sat on it, a framed photograph of Justine, 10 years or so back when she looked a little like Whitney Houston, but she'd put on weight since then, and her pretty face had filled out. It made Haley glad. A neat leather blotter was on the desk, and a silver letter opener, and an old, tired-looking computer terminal that was out of keeping with the rest of the modern decor. Again, she pulled open each of the drawers in the desk, hastily rummaging through them before closing them again and turning her head back at the door every few seconds. That damn curator was out there again, pontificating over the painting. She remembered the way Christopher used to talk about the world of art to her, explaining images and themes and schools in paintings, Renaissance, Dutch, Fete Gallant, Impressionist, Cubist, Surrealist, Native American, the symbolists and precisionists such as Georgia O'Keeffe and Charles Sheeler, whom Christopher had particularly liked. He used to make her feel so good, made her feel intelligent despite her lack of education, made her feel there might be a whole new rich dimension to her life. Then it was snatched away from her, and she went straight back to who she'd always been, Haley Patchett, trailer trash from Brooksville, Florida, home of the tangerine. Only now she was a decade older, on a downward spiral, making money as an escort, pickpocketing her clients, her tricks, when she could, funding a constant and ever more expensive battle to keep her looks. How long would she be able to maintain the image before the cracks became too large to conceal? She continued fishing through the desk's middle drawer. It was full of papers. For a successful woman, Justine was pretty disorganized. But underneath all that was a file. Haley pulled it out, placed it on top of the desk, and opened it. Then she heard the creak of the door and a furious voice behind her. "Just what the hell do you think you're doing?" Justine Olegard. "Shit." Haley grabbed the file and held it to her chest. "I asked you a question." Justine glared at her. "What are you doing in my office?" "Nothing," Haley shrugged. "Nothing? What's that in your hand?" Justine stepped forward and put out her hand. Haley held on to the file, refusing to let go. She couldn't let Justine have it. Not now. Not after all she'd done. Justine lurched forward, trying to grab it out of Haley's hand. "Give me that!" Haley quickly moved back and stumbled, dropping the folder and its contents. She managed to avoid falling by grabbing the edge of the modernist coffee table, knocking over books and a small ceramic sculpture of a tall, thin, elongated man, which skidded to the floor and shattered. Justine stood still for a moment, then said quietly, "That was a Giacometti study. It's priceless." She dropped to her knees and started picking up the broken shards, practically in tears. "Just get the hell out of here," she said, shaking her head. "Too many people here, too much stuff, too many memories banging around in her head, and none of them good." Belle had been trying her best, but she didn't really do crowds. Big gatherings made her nervous. She preferred the peace and quiet of her studio, the isolated life of an artist. She looked around. Faces, so many of them familiar, but all of them were in little groups talking, and right now she didn't have the energy or the courage to interrupt them. Belle drained her wine, put down the glass, and scanned the crowd for the one man she was looking for, Tony Olson. She walked directly over to him and said, "Mr. Olson, I need you to do something for me." Olson smiled. "Of course, Belle. Anything." "I need you to open the case housing my painting. Rosemary's Wishes."
"Why would you want me to do that?"
"Please, Mr. Olson, I promise you'll understand as soon as you open the display case." He stood a moment as if considering what to do, then Belle watched as he located Alex Hultgren and walked out of the room with him. A few minutes later, both men reappeared, and together with Belle went to the small oval room where Waves 27 hung. Olson unlocked the display case and opened the glass door. "Please take the painting down, Mr. Olson."
"But I promised Rosemary it would never come down. Would you mind telling me what this is about, Belle?"
"Please. I also made a promise to Rosemary. Please do as I ask." Olson carefully unhooked the painting from the wall. Bell pulled out a small Swiss Army knife, took hold of the painting, and before Olsen could object, sliced open the thick fabric backing of the frame. A moleskin notebook fell from the interior.
"What is it?"
Olsen asked. Bell didn't answer. She handed him the painting and opened the notebook to the first page, her hands shaking so much she could barely hold it. Then she turned pages, staring at the handwriting of her friend, Rosemary Thomas, crushing away tears with her lashes. She wasn't even aware that Olsen had moved beside her, watching as she flicked through the pages to the last entry. August 22, 2000. 10 years ago. The entry had been written the day before Belle had stood in the viewing room and had seen her friend laid out to die. Belle had recently read that the death rows in U.S. prisons were known as cemeteries for the living. It was true. Rosemary had been dead for all those months with the lethal injection sentence hanging over her, as each of her appeals fell over in turn. Tony Olsen started making his way back to where the rest of the guests were assembled. Belle closed the notebook and followed. She couldn't stop the pictures in her mind, seeing Rosemary strapped down, wrists and ankles and chest, and how they'd opened the curtains so that the witnesses to the execution could watch the deadly injection being administered. All of it came back to Belle now in hideous detail. The botched first attempt, those curtains being opened and closed, and the look on Rosemary's face. She could remember every moment of the long night before, Rosemary's last night. Rosemary had always been composed, almost regal in her bearing, but the stress had lined her face and stooped her shoulders. She'd sat in her orange prison tunic and white sneakers in the small cell, with no window, and the CCTV camera ever watching her, and despite it all, maintained her dignity to the very end. Belle could see Rosemary now, working away in a frenzy on the diary, writing that last entry. When she had finished, they spoke for a while, and she had held Belle's hand, and finally she said, "Belle, let's not talk anymore. Just sit with me." And then, "Just make me one last promise. I want you to keep the diary. Those I've written about will know what it means. But I don't want any of it coming out until after Layla and Ben are old enough. Do you understand? In my will, I've asked for a memorial service on the 10th anniversary of my death. That's when I want you to read it. At the service, not before. Will you promise me that?"
Belle had promised.
Now she glanced at the diary, rubbed a finger over the leather cover and the pages as if to make sure it was real. She looked down again at the pages of that last entry. She remembered Rosemary cursing when her ballpoint pen ran out of ink, and how Belle had to rummage in her purse to find another for her. Belle could see that place where it had happened, that change in color in the ink from blue to black now. When she reached the reception area, she saw Tony Olsen going around the room, whispering into the ears of some of the guests. Silence took hold of the room as the chatter slowly died away. Eventually, it seemed as if someone had hit a freeze-frame button on the event. Every single person in the room had stopped talking and was looking at her. Or, more accurately, at the object she was holding in her hand. Belle looked over at her husband, Don, who was suddenly chewing the inside of his mouth, something he did only when something bothered him that he needed to think about. Then she looked at Peter Hewson, Rosemary's brother. According to Rosemary, he'd been on the verge of bankruptcy before her death, but would benefit handsomely from her estate. Why was he looking as if he'd just bitten into a lemon? Belle wondered. Stan Ballard, Rosemary's lawyer and estate manager, had the face of a man who might not make it to the bathroom in time. He kept switching his weight from one leg to another, tugging his ear, dragging a hand through his hair, adjusting his tie. Haley Patchett and Justine Olegard had taken up positions on opposite sides of the room. Olegard had her arms folded across her chest, face stern, a mask hiding any and all emotion. But Patchett's face seemed to have crumbled a bit, a weariness overtaking her features, mouth droopy, eyes sad, as if something inside her had let go and given up. Belle looked from one person to another. It was like a painting, she thought, a group portrait. Now she realized she was going to enjoy this. She felt a sudden surge of confidence. With a nod and a nervous smile, she opened the diary to the pages Rosemary had written on the last night of her life.
Chapter 23 by Tess Gerritsen. Belle could feel her heart thumping hard. What secrets lay inside? What Pandora's box was she about to open? The last entry is from August 22nd, 2000. She paused, looked up. The day before she was executed.
"Read it," Olson said.
Belle swallowed hard and began to read. "I have become the Invisible Woman. I don't know the precise moment when it happened, when I began to fade from view like the Cheshire Cat, my face dimming until only the ghost of my smile remains. I think it must have started soon after Layla was born. That's when I first noticed that Christopher no longer seemed to look at me, but instead looked through me, as if I had turned transparent. Once your husband stops looking at you, you begin to feel that the rest of the world has stopped looking as well. There was a time when I could catch a man's eye just by wearing a short skirt and high heels. I could walk into a gathering of staid historians and see the startled looks on their faces when they realized that the arms and armor curator was an attractive young woman. And I was attractive. The Rosemary who once was, confident and serene, ready to love and be loved. That woman is gone now. In her place is a woman whom no one seems to see. A woman who walks into rooms unnoticed and unacknowledged. In this, I am not alone. This is what the passage of time does to all women. It thickens our waists, streaks our hair with gray, crinkles the skin around our eyes. But invisibility also has its uses. I certainly found it useful that summer. On this, my final evening on Earth, I don't know why I should be focused on that particular memory. Over the past weeks, I have been reviewing my life, remembering all my bad choices, all the points in time when a wiser decision could have sent me on a path toward a different and happier fate. But this is the fate I am now locked into. And I can't help thinking about one of those crucial points in time. That day in June, when I walked into the lobby of the Coronado Hotel. That was the day my future was sealed. It was not my first visit to that grand old hotel. Years before, as a newlywed, I had strolled through the lobby in a sundress and had seen a bellman stare admiringly at my legs. But this time, when I walked in, no one looked at me. I was just a mousy, brown-haired matron in a shapeless shirt and slacks, scarcely worth a glance when there were other females to stare at, young females who still had the glow of youth. They hadn't lost their figures to motherhood. Their shoulders weren't bowed from the humiliations of marriage to Christopher Thomas. It's as if I am there now. I watch one of those magnificent specimens walk past me in the lobby. She has shiny hair and perfect skin and the stride of a woman who knows she is beautiful. Enjoy it while you can, honey, I think, because someday you'll be where I am, exactly where I am. I hunch deep in a chair, and the woman doesn't see me as she walks past into the cocktail lounge, but I can see her. perfectly. I see her glide across to the bar counter. I see her tap the shoulder of a man seated there. He turns, smiles at her, and reaches an arm around her waist to pat her ass. It is a gesture of easy familiarity, the way a man might greet his wife. The problem is, that man's wife is me. I watch as the shiny-haired woman and Christopher leave the cocktail lounge and stroll hand in hand to the grand stairway. They are too wrapped up in their lust. They don't notice me follow them up the two flights of stairs into the historic section of the hotel. They head down a charming but creaky hallway and disappear into a guest room. The door closes, and I hear the privacy lock click shut. I cannot help myself. I stand outside the room and imagine what's going on behind the closed door. I picture the clothes strewn on the floor, the naked bodies on the bed. I picture my husband's hands on that woman's silky young body, a body that has not given him two children and a decade of devotion. Why did I torment myself that way? Why did I follow him when I already knew the purpose of his trip? Not business, as he'd claimed. No, it's never about business. After all the women I've had to suffer through, I knew exactly what he was up to whenever he'd disappear for a few days, or even for just a few hours. Suddenly, standing outside the room, I can bear it no longer. I leave that closed door and walk out of the building to the garden courtyard. There, I call the only person I can call about this. I have little regard for him, but at least in this case, his interests are aligned with mine. I have to find a way to divorce him, Peter. I can't deal with it any longer. My brother, never one for sympathy, gives an impatient sigh. This again. You always say it, and you never follow through. Because of the children. They'll get over a breakup. Kids always manage. No, it's not that. It's Chris. He'll fight me for them. Why? He doesn't give a damn about them. But he does give a damn about the money. He'll use them as a bargaining chip to squeeze every penny he can out of me. Only then does my brother take me seriously. Money has that effect on him.
He can't do that, says Peter. The money is from our family.
But the children are his, too, and if he gets custody of them...
He could get his hands on their trust fund, Peter says, finishing for me.
Peter is clever when he wants to be. This could complicate your life, too. It's all tied together, all our investments.
What are you suggesting?
I don't know. I don't know what to do. I want to be rid of him, but at the same time...
What do you want me to do?
I don't know. I can't think straight. I just want the pain to be over with. I want to stop hurting. Peter laughed.
Well, Rosie, you know Christopher. Maybe one of his underworld connections will get sick of him one day and make a merry little widow out of you.
I didn't say anything to that, because at times, deep down, I would have welcomed such an outcome. This was one of them. Peter, I'm asking for a little reassurance. I want to know that Ben and Layla will always be taken care of, that they'll be safe and comfortable no matter what.
Well, that much is assured. They've got generous trust funds.
But will it stay generous, even if something happens to me?
What could happen to you? And even if something did, I'm their uncle. You think I'd let them be robbed blind?
You mean it, Peter? You would look after them? Even as I ask this, I realize it is out of sheer desperation that I have no one else to ask. Of course Peter lets me down.
Look, why don't you go get a stiff drink or something, he says. Take your mind off this. You're just working yourself up over nothing.
That's Peter's answer to everything, a stiff drink. But this time, maybe it's good advice. I hang up and go to the bar. But two martinis later, my mind is still chewing over the image of my husband and that woman on the bed. I wonder who she is. I've never seen her before. When and where did he meet her? Does she know he's married? Does she know anything about him? I'm feeling drunk and reckless as I go to the hotel's front desk. Excuse me, I say. I've lost my key. It's to room 215. The last name is Thomas.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but I'll need to see ID.
Of course. I show him my driver's license. I'm gambling that Chris checked in under his real name. The gamble pays off. He has taken a woman to our honeymoon hotel and has not bothered or cared enough to hide his identity. Here you go, Mrs. Thomas, the clerk says, and he hands me a key card. I wait until Chris and his latest slut are dining in the restaurant. Then I make my way to their room and let myself in. Inside, I find rumpled bedsheets, damp towels on the floor. In the bathroom, I find a woman's makeup bag, open it, and take out a vial of pills. The woman's name is printed clearly. All I know about her is that she takes sleeping pills. And I know her name. Haley Patchett. Belle stopped reading and looked up, her eyes locking on Haley's. The room had gone absolutely silent, everyone staring at Haley. Haley looked down at the floor, muttered, "Excuse me," and left the room.
"Go on," Nunn told Belle.
Belle cleared her throat and continued where she'd left off. On that awful night, when I saw her again at the Pollock opening, after Chris had asked me for a divorce, it was just too much, and I blew up. What a mistake that was. That's the instant I recall when my life began to spin out of control. But Haley was just another conquest, another in a long string of women who were used and abandoned by Chris. There's only one woman I know of who had the courage and decency to stand up to him and refuse his advances. And he made certain she suffered for it. Which is why I will always consider Belle McGuire my friend. Belle stopped again, seemed to catch her breath before she continued. But she was the one shining exception. The others were only too eager to be used. I've learned to feel sorry for them, to think of them as merely weak-willed victims. I write about them now only to explain what kind of man I've been married to. It's a poor defense, I know, but it's the one defense I can offer to my children, who will one day read these words. This, my final entry, is for them. Dearest Ben and Layla, I have asked my friend Belle to keep this diary until the appropriate moment. By the time you hear these words, you will both be adults and in full control of your own funds. You'll no longer need a protector, and you'll be ready to know the truth. Sitting alone in my jail cell, night after night, I have repeatedly wondered if my phone conversation with Peter that afternoon in the hotel sealed your father's fate. I've even wondered whether I'm passively guilty. My brother's primary motivation in life has always been money, and I've always known that. Did he panic when he heard me blow off at your father about the divorce? I cannot fathom my brother being capable of such a crime, let alone letting me die in his place. Besides, I have no evidence, and the law only considers evidence, and all the evidence somehow points to me. You have been told that I am a murderer, that I killed your father. It may have been true that at times I wished him dead, but I did not kill him. I struck no blows, drew no blood. It's important to me that you both know this. Now the day comes to a close, and tomorrow is my last. I love you both, my darlings, and will forever blow you kisses from heaven. Always your mother, Rosemary Hewson Thomas. Slowly, Belle closed the diary and said softly, "Those were the last words she wrote."
"How do we know any of it's true?" Stan Ballard snapped. "That diary's like a deathbed confession," said Hank Zacharias.
"She just finished writing this when she gave it to me," Belle said. "She had no reason to lie."
Nunn took a breath, looked directly at Peter Hewson, and said, "We have to assume that Rosemary did tell the truth, which means that she did not kill her husband."
Chapter 24 by Lisa Scottolini. "No, she didn't. But thanks to you, Detective, she's dead." It was Ben Thomas, Rosemary's son. Although at first glance the young man seemed to have an almost uncanny resemblance to his father, the eyes that now bored into Nunn's looked very much like Rosemary's. His sister was standing beside him looking at the floor, her rich brown hair partially covering her face. Few of the guests had seen the Thomas children since the trial. They'd been away at school, and later college. Ben walked over to Nunn, his demeanor cool. "So now you know what we've always known, that our mother didn't kill our father. What did it have to take for you to realize that?" Nunn was quiet. The entire room had gone quiet. "What did it have to take for you to do your job and investigate our dear Uncle Peter?" Ben turned around and glared at Peter Hewson. Peter sighed impatiently. "Why would I want to kill your father?" Layla Thomas looked up. "Why? Mom says why in the diary. Money. It's always been the only thing you've cared about. It's never been enough for you." She looked at her brother. "He used to dip into our trust funds before we were old enough to ask questions." Peter polished off his drink and cleared his throat. "That's a lie," he shrieked. Then he took a deep breath. "Listen, no one knew your mother better than I, and no one loved her more, and you know that. But Rosie had gone nuts in that jail cell day after day waiting to die. We can't take those ramblings of hers seriously." He looked at Stan Ballard. "She cracked up, remember?" Ballard just nodded. Layla had crossed the room and was standing across from her uncle, looking him directly in the face. "Don't you ever stop, Uncle Peter. Our mom was a wonderful and loving person, and was framed for a murder she didn't commit, and she suffered so many disgraces in her life." Layla stopped, her gaze shifting to Justine, who looked down, avoiding the younger woman's eyes. Layla turned to look at Peter again. "And now you're disgracing her and her death!" She reached up and slapped him, hard, across the face. Peter's eyes flashed with resentment. He stared at his niece for a moment, then turned and left the room. Ben Thomas moved over to stand beside his sister. Tony Olson came forward, took the diary from Belle, closed it with care, and handed it to Ben. "This belongs to you, to both of you. It's a living legacy, and your mother would want you to have it. You're its rightful owners." Ben accepted the diary. Layla blinked away tears. "Thank you." Tony walked over and rested a comforting hand on her shoulder. "You know,
I never believed your mother had anything to do with it.
I know,
Layla said. I was secretly hoping we'd expose a murderer tonight. And we might have, he whispered in her ear. The girl looked up at him and nodded.
Chapter 25 by Philip Margolin. Nunn knew he had to get away for a few minutes. He needed to be alone. Needed to mull over what had just happened. So he headed for the ramp to the lower exhibit gallery and the exit. A guard had been stationed at the ramp, but he was now gone. When Nunn got to the ground floor, he wandered through the darkened halls, preoccupied by his thoughts about what he'd just heard, until he found himself in the arms and armor room. He walked around the room, then stopped when he walked past one of the display cases. Something was wrong. The case contained daggers and swords. Each was labeled with information about the artifact. One of the labels read, Rondel Dagger, 14th Century. But there was a space where the dagger should have been. He was walking over to the case so he could examine it more closely when he heard a scream echoing through the marble halls of the museum. Hank Zacharias could sense a news story when other reporters were oblivious to what was going on around them. But he didn't need any special instinct to know that a hideous scream at a museum was out of place. He was off and running. He made the turn into the corridor and was surprised to see Tony Olson walking down the hall toward him. Olson's shoulder was even with the door to the ladies' room, and Hank thought he saw the door closing, but he couldn't be certain.
"Did you hear a scream?" Olson asked.
"Yeah, I thought it came from this hall," said Zacharias.
"I already passed the offices," Olson said, pointing to the rooms on the other side of the hall from the restrooms, "and there's no one in any of them."
"That leaves the bathrooms." Hank pushed open the door to the men's room, which was empty.
"In here!"
Olson shouted from the ladies' room. Hank got his cell phone and darted inside. Haley Patchett lay crumpled on the floor. Hank snapped a quick photo of the young woman and a close-up of the blood that was coming from a nasty gash on the back of her head.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
Olson shouted. Hank took a step closer to Haley, but Olson pushed him away.
"Go outside and keep everyone away from here," said Olson. "And get someone to call the police."
Everyone was huddled around the door to the ladies' room. Nunn pushed his way inside. He found Tony Olson and a horrified Haley Patchett, who was seated on the floor with her back pressed against the wall. Haley had a hand to the back of her head, and blood was seeping between the matted strands of her red hair.
"What happened?" Nunn asked.
I don't know," Haley said. "I was fixing my lipstick when I saw a shadow across the mirror. The next thing I remember is opening my eyes and seeing him."
She pointed at Tony Olson. Olson looked up at Nunn.
"I was with Zacharias when I found her."
Nunn nodded.
"Do you think the attacker was already in here when you came in, or do you think whoever it was followed you in?"
Haley just shook her head. Two policemen rushed up the ramp toward the ladies' room, and a few minutes later, Haley Patchett came out, a bandage on the back of her head.
"I'm fine," she announced to a confused and worried crowd. "It's just a scratch."
She was embarrassed everyone was staring at her. Hank Zacharias had rejoined the group but hung back, whispering on his cell, calling the story in.
Chapter 26 by Jeffrey Deaver. "Crazy night, huh?" the crime scene officer who'd just come said to the security guard sitting behind the massive desk in the front lobby of the museum. "Rates is one of the strangest," the guard answered the cop, who along with his partner was assembling their gear. The two police officers who'd initially responded to the call had left, but not before asking him a few questions. The poor lady with the cut on her head had also left the museum, but in an ambulance. The guard glanced up at the crime scene officers again. They were wearing those outfits, jumpsuits and booties and hats and masks, that made them look more like surgeons than cops. They'd come in to process the scene. He knew that was the term they used because he watched CSI. The guard looked outside and noticed the crime scene van parked on the curb. Beside it, another ambulance that had responded to the call. "What's with the second ambulance?" the guard asked the taller of the crime scene cops. "That's how it is sometimes. More than one ambulance shows up. Are they having a party in there?" "It's a memorial." "What's your piece?" the first cop was nodding at the pistol on the security guard's hip. "Oh, just a Colt, 38. They don't let us carry automatics here. I don't know why." "How about that? I've got a 38 as my backup." He glanced down at his ankle. "Nice weapon." "Totally dependable," the guard said proudly, pleased a cop had liked his choice of gun. "You have a backup?" "Me," the guard replied with a laugh. "Not hardly." "Ah, good." "Good?" the guard asked uncertainly, wondering why it was good. Then his mind did a leap, and it occurred to him that it made no sense for crime scene officers to be here. That only made sense if... "Tell you what," the taller cop said. "Lift your hands out to your sides." "Oh, no," the guard said miserably as he felt the other officer behind him touch a gun to his skull. "This is... shit, this is all a setup, isn't it? You're not cops. You're hitting the place, aren't you?" "Hands," the first one repeated. The guard lifted his hands. He felt like crying. "You're not gonna hurt me, are you?" The second cop, well, fake cop, pulled the 38 from the guard's holster. His wallet, too. The first one asked, "What's your half of the code to the special exhibit room? The one in the tower?" The room that contained a traveling exhibition of some small but important Renaissance drawings and prints. It had taken a year to get the Vatican to agree to lend the masterpieces, and they only did it because the museum installed a special security system that required two people to open it.
"Oh, they don't tell us that,"
a voice behind him. "Who's the little girl in the picture?" The guard whirled around and saw the second fake cop looking through his wallet.
"Your daughter, right? Is she at home now?"
The guard started to cry.
"I only know half the code."
"That's all I asked for," was the calm reply.
177 AMK question mark 831. "The letters are caps. It's case sensitive," the guard blurted out breathlessly. "Please, I'll do anything..."
The first cop jotted the code.
"If this is right, you don't need to do anything else."
A nod, and in a moment the guard was duct-taped and being dragged into the cloakroom nearby. As they left, they shut the lights off, leaving him in darkness to consider how careless he'd been in not following the strictest security protocols, and to consider what kind of nightmare was about to unfold in the tower room. They went by the names of Bob and Frank, names that were short, but more important, distinct, so if they were working with a third person, there'd be no confusion as to who was being summoned. The men were professional thieves, killers too, though there'd been a major decrease in the market for hitmen lately, because that job was relatively easy. Quality guns and explosives were cheap and easily available, but good thieves were hard to come by. A trace-free B&E required a lot of technical skill, so they'd reaped a windfall in fees over the past few years. After dumping the guard in the cloakroom, they'd returned to the lobby. They were still in the crime scene outfits that had allowed them access into the museum. They wore these as often as they could on a job, because the outfits protected them from sloughing off trace evidence as efficiently as they prevented cops from contaminating crime scenes. Bob now walked to the front door of the museum, looked out, and unlocked it. He waved to their accomplices, the men posing as paramedics in the fake ambulance. One of the fake medics looked up. Bob called, 10 minutes. We'll secure the room and let you know when it's clear."
"We're all set."
Frank and Bob climbed the stairs toward the large room at the top of the tower. At the top, they paused only long enough to double-check their Beretta pistols and make sure the silencers were properly mounted. Then they glanced at each other, nodded, and turned the corner, walking into the room where the guests were still assembled, talking among themselves about what had already happened that night, downing drinks to calm their nerves. The attendees didn't at first notice the intrusion, but then somebody gasped, somebody else cried out, and the rest of the crowd turned.
"Wait, who are you? What are you doing here?"
Other pointless questions and screams. Emotion, such a waste of time and energy, Bob thought.
"No one touch a cell phone," he called in a calm voice. "I want everybody on your knees and lace your hands behind your head. If you don't, you'll get shot."
No one did anything for a moment, which was typical, and then a bulky man, an older guy in a suit, strode his way. "I don't know what this..." Bob shot him in the head twice, blood flecking the wall and the clothes of those standing near. More screams and gasps. A pretty dark-haired teenage girl in a dark blue dress, horror on her face, ran toward the body. Bob raised his pistol to shoot her, too, but she controlled herself, dropped to her knees, then put her hands behind her neck. Crying, gasping, begging, everyone else followed her lead. Bob then did a fast head count. Hell, two of the guests were missing. Frank noticed the same. Bob pointed his gun at the girl again.
"Where are the others?" he called to the crowd. "Tell me or I shoot her in 5 seconds."
But no more bloodletting was necessary. Just then, two men turned the corner from a dark corridor leading off the tower and froze at the sight of the two intruders. Frank, the closer of the robbers, trained his weapon on them. One of the men, whom the robber took to be in better shape than his friend, glanced at the body, then at Frank, then at Bob. They got the impression the man was quickly analyzing the scene. Bob would need to keep a special eye on him. When the two new guests were on their knees and Bob was covering them all, Frank carefully frisked everyone. When he identified Justine Olegaard, he said,
"I need the second half of the code to the special exhibit room. I have the first half. The wall alarm codes, too."
"But..."
"We showed you we have no problem killing anybody. I want the code now or I'll kill... her." He stepped forward and pointed the gun at an attractive 30-something, blonde and pretty.
"No!" cried the burly man beside her.
"Don, don't say anything to him," she said. "Don't make him mad."
The guy with her, Don apparently, shouted to Justine, "Give him the code, please!" Justine nodded. Bob pulled her to her feet and walked her to the door of the special exhibit room. He stopped her at the keypad and typed in the first half of the code. Then she typed in the rest. A faint buzz, and they pushed the double doors open, then stepped into the exhibit hall. She flicked the lights on. The place was filled with old sketches and prints that Bob knew must have been worth millions. The crop was free for the harvest. It was time to earn his $500,000 fee. Bob pulled a walkie-talkie off his belt and hit the transmit button.
"We're secure,"
he radioed the fake paramedics. A moment later, a crackling answer.
"Roger, we're on our way."
Bob led Justine back into the main room. He deposited her back on her knees. Then he caught a glimpse of that man he'd noted earlier, the big guy. Bob walked up to him.
"What's your name?"
"John Nunn." Bob stared down coldly at him, but Nunn held his eyes without a problem. In fact, he was looking back in a funny way, studying him, it seemed. With the shower hat, the booties, the face mask, and the jumpsuit, there was no chance of getting a description. But Bob had an odd feeling that this Nunn was committing some kind of a description to memory, looking for attributes that could later be used in an investigation or at trial. How Bob walked, how he stood, left hand versus right hand, height, weight. Time to kill this prick. He lifted the gun, started to pull the trigger.
Then the elevator door opened and the paramedics walked into the room. Bob frowned. Shit, hadn't they gotten the instructions right? They were supposed to bring the